At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's a little bit like moving through all the stages of grief, right? As the economy slows, everybody reacts in their own way. Traders do one thing, the Fed does another, consumers do yet a third, as we all get used to life after the bailout. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, working to provide responsible, sustainable energy to power America's future. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. Sustainability reporting is supported by Johnson Controls, making homes, cars, and workplaces more comfortable, safe, and sustainable. Johnson Controls, where ingenuity is welcome.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, the 16th of October. Great to have you here for more of Fallout, our coverage of the financial crisis, and increasingly, what comes next. One of the things on our list of things to do in that regard is track how well the bailout is working. Lots of ways to measure that, of course. Interest rate spreads are one. We told you about those yesterday. Today, it's the Federal Reserve and how much money the central bank has left in the bank. And speaking of the Fed, we'll ask a guy who used to sit on the board there, now what are they going to do? When banks don't lend, one side effect is that hundreds of billions of dollars in cash accumulates, unused, at the Federal Reserve. Those reserve balances, as they're known, have hit historic highs in the past couple of weeks. And today the Fed announced its stash of unused cash has gotten even bigger despite the bailouts. From Washington, Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
To give you a sense of how big this credit crunch is, just think back to the World Trade Center attacks. They tore a hole in global financial markets. Right after the attacks, the reserve balances at the Fed started accumulating, virtually overnight, says James Hamilton, an economist at the University of California. Reserves rose from just a few billion to $67 billion.
Because of the terrific shock to the infrastructure, the reserves would just pile up and there wasn't a functioning market to lend them between banks.
But the breakdown in lending this month was even bigger. Last week, commercial banks parked more than $175 billion in unused cash in their Fed accounts.
Almost two and a half times the size of that huge disruption that came in September 2001.
After the shocks of September 11th, it took a couple weeks for the financial system to return to normal and for banks to begin lending to each other again. In this crisis, that's not happening. This week, the pile of unused cash sitting in Fed accounts shot up $90 billion to $265 billion, according to the Fed. Hamilton says that's a sign credit markets are still frozen. But Doug Diamond at the University of Chicago's Graduate School of Business says it's no cause for alarm. He believes once the bailouts are in place, they should work, but it will take time for confidence to return and for banks to stop hoarding their money.
I would say it would take on the range of a month from now.
In the meantime, Diamond says, the Fed has begun to pay interest on those deposits. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Interesting that Steve mentioned interest, because interest rates are one of the tools the Fed has to manage the aftermath of the financial crisis. Frederick Mishkin teaches at the Graduate School of Business at Columbia University. More importantly, until about a month and a half ago, he was a member of the board of the Federal Reserve. Welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
I'd love your thoughts for a second on the timing of where we are in the economy. Have we now made the turn from planning this bailout to managing the recession?
We can't know that yet. Clearly, we're in the throes of a major financial crisis, and there's been very large government interventions, not just in the United States, but also abroad. But we don't know whether they're going to completely work yet. And even if they do work, which I am hopeful they will, that there's still a problem that there are long lags from what happens in terms of policies and what happens to the economy. So the negative effects of this financial crisis are going to be felt down in the future. And indeed, even if things work, the economy could get worse.
Let me call on you then in your role as a former member of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve. What are they saying to themselves these days as they sit around that table trying to plan things out, bearing that lag you just mentioned in mind?
Well, I can't tell you what they're actually thinking right now because I'm not sitting at the table with them. But the important thing is that when you do monetary policy, you have to ask yourself not just what's happening today, but ask yourself what you think is going to happen down the road, because monetary policy takes a long time to have its effects, and therefore what you have to do is to think about where you want things year to 2 years down the road, and that's how you have to set monetary policy today.
Monetary policy being interest rates, of course.
Setting the federal funds rate is the main tool of monetary policy.
One of the things the Fed does when it sets that rate is it looks at inflation, right? Chairman Bernanke is well known to have a special affection for the inflation number.
Absolutely. That a central bank always has to worry about price stability. In the long run, that's the most important thing that it does. Clearly, in the short run, it also has to worry about other things as well, in particular, keeping the economy on an even keel, and also making sure that, in fact, the financial system doesn't blow up.
Well, then look at the number that was out today that showed consumer prices essentially flat. What does that tell you about what the Fed might be planning?
One of the key issues has been that inflation has actually been very high recently, but there have been very temporary influences on this. This was the fact that we had this huge run-up in oil prices, and oil prices have come down from over $140 a barrel to below 80, and you can see it at the gas pump. It was a great pleasure. It just filled up yesterday. And I felt pretty good that I was paying well under $4 a gallon, and that's something that I haven't seen in a long time, particularly in New York where I am, where they have high taxes on gasoline.
What's next in this scenario?
Always hard to know. There has been some improvement in credit markets recently, and I hope that continues. That's really the key. What happens to the stock market is really a sideshow, even though it affects all of us, because if you own stocks and they go down, you feel poorer, and that certainly has happened to me. But the real issue is, are the credit markets going to get working again? If the credit markets get working again, the economy will bounce back and we will not have a severe recession. But if credit markets take a long time to come back, then we'll have more problems.
Frederick Mishkin at the Graduate School of Business at Columbia University, also formerly of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States. Professor, thanks a lot for your time.
You're very welcome.
Yes, ho-hum, another triple-digit swing on Wall Street today. Up, though, this time. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Dow Industrial swung through 9.5% today, 4.5% down at one point, then it finished almost 5 back on the upside. So I hear you when you say, man, what is going on? About a million different things, but big hedge funds are one of the major causes. Hedge funds, just to refresh, are those huge, mostly unregulated piles of money that are invested by big institutions and generally wealthy individuals. A growing number of them, though, have gone from big winners to big losers. This week, Dallas-based Highland Capital Management announced it's shutting down two of its funds, blaming what it calls unprecedented market volatility. Our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, has more.
When times were good, the hedge fund industry promised and mostly delivered outsized returns. To make that money, the funds used leverage, borrowing heavily to buy shares and other securities. But the credit crunch has pushed up the cost of those loans. That's part of the reason hedge fund returns are down as much as 8%. Now Desmond Lachman of the American Enterprise Institute says unhappy customers are scrambling to cash out.
Investors in these hedge funds don't see the reason why they should be paying these hedge funds very high fees if the hedge fund's performance has been so abysmal.
Lachman believes that's feeding stock market volatility.
You're talking about a rather big force in the financial markets. So if we begin to see hedge funds like Highland or Citadel suffering very big losses, going out of business, having to liquidate, that is a very important factor that keeps downward pressure on equity prices, bond prices, you name it.
Christopher Holt is a market commentator who specializes in hedge funds at the website All About Alpha. He doubts a stock sell-off by the hedge funds is the major factor behind the market's recent volatility.
You know, it takes a lot more than just hedge funds to move the market to this extent. Hedge funds are a $2 trillion industry, which is apparently shrinking this quarter. To what extent, we have yet to find out. But the mutual fund industry is well over $10 trillion.
Still, the AEI's Desmond Lachman worries the hedge fund troubles are a symptom of a much bigger problem. He says financial rescue measures are failing to keep mortgage values and other depressed assets from falling further. He suggests a full-scale economic stimulus plan is urgently needed. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Crude dropped briefly below $69 a barrel today. That's less than half its record high this past summer. Worked out pretty well for most airline stocks today, but Southwest is not most airlines. The discount carrier has been in the black every single quarter for the past 17 years, until this one. It's managed to make money recently by playing its fuel hedges just right. Now that oil prices are dropping, though, Southwest's fuel contracts have cut into profits. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports from North Carolina Public Radio.
Southwest's oil hedging prowess has made it the master of the airline universe. The company locked in low-cost fuel prices in advance. As a result, its bottom line soared, while competitors' profits were eaten up by rising oil prices. Travel analyst Peter Yesowicz says Southwest bet right on oil for a long time. But in this volatile market,
trying to predict the price of a barrel of oil is a little bit like playing Russian roulette today.
Oil prices fell so fast last quarter that Southwest had to take a $247 million accounting charge. It's also put its hedging on hold. But analyst Ray Neidel at Calion Securities says it's just a temporary setback.
Southwest, like other airlines, is still going to benefit going forward from lower oil prices.
That doesn't mean the airlines will escape a drop in demand. As the economy weakens, companies have started pulling back on business trips. Airlines that specialize in business class to and from financial hubs have already felt the backslide, and consumers will likely be next to rein in travel. Still, Neidel's cautiously optimistic. Things are so bad everywhere else that by comparison, he says airlines are starting to see some blue sky.
The airline industry is no longer the worst industry. Airlines had their crisis last year and earlier this year when oil prices went up, and as a result, they prepared for this.
They cut back on flights and reduced capacity, a trend expected to continue into next spring. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Popular anger over the government giving more help to big banks than to homeowners has gone public inside the Bush administration. The chairman of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation is publicly criticizing the bailout package. Sheila Bair says it doesn't do enough to help Americans about to lose their homes, as Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports.
FDIC Chairman Sheila Bair told the Wall Street Journal she's frustrated with the bailout package. She said defaulting borrowers were at the root of the crisis, so why not tackle the borrower problem, she argues. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, on the other hand, have been focused on saving banks. John Taylor, president of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, says Paulson and Bernanke aren't thinking outside their box.
I think they're from that club. You know, their club is Wall Street. That's where they come from. Their orientation is that. That's how they see the world working. And they just thought that they have a lot more time to sort of deal with the homeowner problems, and they don't.
We're talking about potentially helping millions of struggling homeowners. Taylor says the country's facing 300,000 home foreclosure filings a month. But backers of the bailout plan, including the Financial Services Roundtable, a Wall Street lobbying group, say there is help for homeowners through programs like the Hope for Homeowners program. Spokesman Scott Talbot defends the bailout plan's banks-first approach.
The financial institutions are the engine for the economy. They are the oil in the system. If they cannot lend, then all other services shut down. So it's better to do a wholesale approach with the economy that benefits everybody than working in reverse.
But one mortgage consultant who wants more in the bailout package for homeowners says housing was the catalyst for the economic crisis. Housing got us in, he says. Housing's got to get us out. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Even on a day like today, when the Dow was up 400 points, there are some losers out there, companies whose share prices just couldn't keep up. And the way the markets have been going lately, there have been far more losers than winners. When a stock falls, investors have a pretty good idea of what that means to them. Sleepless nights if the losses are big enough, less money to retire on, and maybe a cheaper education for their children. But what does it mean for the company? Marketplace's Jeff Tyler considers the chain of events triggered by a slide in a company's stock price.
When a stock's price goes up, no money comes into the company, and no money goes out when the price goes down. Instead, the stock price acts as a reflection of the company.
The stock market is quite important for the perception of a company.
That's New York University economics professor Richard Silla.
Every day the stock market is like an election on how well the company's doing. If people say, I like that stock, they push the price of the stock up, then the company may find it easier to get a loan from a bank.
When the stock price is down, bankers consider it a bad sign and are not so eager to part with their money. Sound familiar? And it's not just buyers, sellers, and lenders who judge a company by its share price. Executives running the place can also learn a thing or two from the markets, says Stanford business professor Jonathan Burke.
They might care about the stock price because the stock price must be giving them information that they wouldn't otherwise have.
Take Apple, for example. Its stock has fallen from around $180 a share down to around $100. That's a 40% drop in 2 months. Burke says Apple knows a lot about building and marketing an iPhone.
But they may not know so much about the future demand of iPhones, and perhaps investors, as a group, know more about that.
Of course, the markets can be wrong, creating a false impression of a company's worth. That perception can become a reality. A falling stock price can actually drive down business. Consider carmakers Ford and GM. Their shares have been hammered. Ford stock now trades for less than a gallon of gas. Professor Silla says that sends a signal to car buyers to think twice.
Well, that means the company's going to perhaps disappear. I better not buy that company's products because I might not be able to get a spare part, or the dealership might disappear in the case of an automobile company.
In that respect, Silla says a falling stock price has a direct impact on the bottom line.
The decline in the share value doesn't just hurt investors, but it hurts the actual workers in the company and the management because it makes it harder for them to sell their products.
And managers may be less likely to make bold business decisions that could turn things around. Hayne Leland, a finance professor at UC Berkeley, says a low share price can make executives overly cautious.
Managers may tend to become much more risk-averse, to hoard cash, and basically undertake fewer investments than they otherwise might have done.
That is, if the manager isn't too busy focusing on his own career. Leland says sinking share prices make stock options worthless. That means some employees will make less money than they expected.
A low stock price can have a real impact on managerial incentives and even their willingness perhaps to stay with the firm.
If there is a firm to stay with, a depressed stock price also makes a company vulnerable to a hostile takeover. And we all know what happens then. The share price goes up. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Coming up, with the economy, it's always been a matter of trust. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials were down 380 points at one point today, but finished 401 in the black. That's a 4.2% gain to close at 8,979. The NASDAQ climbed 89 points, about 5.5%, ended the day at 1717. The S&P 500 gained 38 points, 4.25% to finish at 946. Crude oil dipped below $70 a barrel today, and that's an airline stock soaring. Delta and Northwest were up about 19%. Continental rose 22%. U.S. Airways up 28%. And shares in the parent company of United Airlines skyrocketed 40% today. That's 4-0. Even Southwest managed a gain of 8% despite the fuel hedging problems we mentioned to you earlier. AIG apparently wasn't the only life insurance company buying mortgage-backed securities. Analysts say life insurers face a, quote, significant risk of downgrades because they lost so much money in bad investments. Lincoln National dropped 15% today. Hartford Financial off almost 12%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. Who can you trust? The banks? Our elected officials? Financial advisors?
That question and more this weekend on a special Marketplace Money show dedicated to America's financial crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. President Bush addresses the U.S. Chamber of Commerce about the economy. Microsoft launches KIND, Kids in Need of Defense. It's a charity dedicated to providing lawyers to kids in immigration court. And on this day in 1931, gang leader Al Capone was convicted on tax evasion and sentenced to 11 years. I'm Caitlin Carroll.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Sadly enough, I was out at Dodger Stadium last night watching the Dodgers lose the National League title to the Philadelphia Phillies. Sad, I suppose, if you're a fan, but nothing compared to the baseball drama going on in Chicago. The Cubs, which are now going on 101 years without a World Series title, are looking for a new owner. A sale of that size isn't an easy thing to do in this economic climate. Mark Cuban, owner of basketball's Dallas Mavericks, is offered $1.3 billion. He's popular enough with fans, but he makes other owners nervous. Cuban's tell-it-like-it-is attitude has cost him $2 million in fines to the NBA. ESPN's Gene Wojciechowski has been covering that deal. Gene, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So aside from his antics, who is Mark Cuban really?
Well, he's sort of a child entrepreneur. And he sort of made his bones really early in his life. He was just a clever kid who knew how to work business. And he's a guy who sort of is a visionary because he understands the economics of things.
Now he's in the mix to buy the Chicago Cubs. Where does that transaction stand in terms of the Cubs getting a new owner?
Well, they had hoped to have this thing wrapped up basically by now, or at least in the home stretch. But I don't think they're really anywhere very close right now. They basically have made a first cut. And Cuban made sort of the varsity team of bidders. But there's still a lot of work to do. It's still a very fluid situation. And Cuban even recently said that with the economic downturn that he definitely wants to buy the Cubs. But I think he's sort of hoping that they put a little lower sales price on it.
Is he going to be able to get a lower sales price, or is he going to have a tougher time finding financing? I mean, those two are sort of interrelated, right?
Well, Sam Zell is going to try to wring as much money as he can out of the Chicago Cubs and Wrigley Field as he can. So I think he'd be very, very reluctant to lower the price on anything, including a paperclip.
Baseball ownership, of course, is not the most wild and crazy collection of guys you're ever going to meet. Cuban, I imagine, is meeting some resistance amongst the ownership.
I would guess that Mark Cuban right now is trying to build as many bridges of understanding and extending handshakes and sort of trying to soothe some of the feelings that he's ruffled through the years and try to show some of these more traditional conservative Major League Baseball owners that, you know, he can play nice because he has to get three-quarters approval from the other owners.
Once he gets past that hurdle, though, assuming he does, you mentioned he understands the economics of big league sports pretty well. Is he going to be able to make a whole lot of money off the Cubs? Does this deal make sense for him?
He understands. Wrigley, I mean, it's been called, you know, the world's largest beer garden because they open up the doors, everybody comes in, and they just have a great time. It's sold out just about every game as long as they're competitive. So I think he would keep them competitive, and I think that revenue stream would continue.
Do you think Cuban being inside baseball's ownership would change baseball at all?
I hope so. I think Cuban, if he played it smart, if he was able to explain to the other owners why this would be a good idea, they would listen. Because MLB has actually done a few things in recent years that have made a lot of sense. They started their MLB.com. Their MLB network is going to be firing up here in January. So they understand that there's money to be made out there. And Cuban has a long history. He understands that part of the equation. So I think he'd be a real asset for the other owners. It's just a matter of, are we going to get Mark Cuban, the guy who is sort of this brat, or are we going to get the really smart businessman who can really add value to everybody? And that's going to be the key. Not only adding value to the Chicago Cubs, but how is he going to add value to everybody else's franchises?
Gene Wojciechowski writes for ESPN and ESPN.com. We reached him, obviously, in Chicago. Gene, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
One of the questions that's out there in the economy today is whether or not this country trusts the people in the institutions that are trying to untangle the fallout from the financial crisis. Trust itself can be a subjective thing, but its effects can be starkly objective, because if you don't trust that you'll be led out of a crisis, why would you follow? Marketplace's Tess Vigeland has been doing some looking into that. Hiya, Tess.
Hi, Kai.
So do we think it's fair at this point to say that a lot of Americans have just lost trust and confidence in our big financial institutions?
Judging from our inbox, absolutely. People don't know if there's anywhere safe to put their money at this point. You know, the stock market's lost, what, 6,000 points since this time last year or so. Banks are failing, though that is notable more for the size of the failures than the number of them this year. People are blaming the banks for handing out all those bad mortgages in the first place. And no one seems to be able to agree on how we get ourselves out of this mess.
That's anecdotal from our listener inbox. What about the cold hard facts? What are the polls saying?
Well, we have had a couple of polls done recently that do deal with this issue of trust and confidence. Gallup has some numbers from the end of September, so this is just a couple of weeks ago, showing that the number of Americans who have either a great deal or quite a lot of confidence in our banks, it's down 9 percentage points from June of 07 to just 32%. 32% of people have confidence in the banks. And the last time it was that low, Kai, March of 1991, in the wake of the S&L crisis.
That obviously is for banks, financial institutions, those kinds of things. What about the government, the people who are supposed to be able to fix this?
Yeah, supposed to be able to. According to the most recent poll from the Pew Research Center, just over half the population says the government does have the power to fix the economy. But in July, that figure was 70%. And a Gallup poll that was just taken last weekend asked a very similar question, and that survey found 37% think the government can have a great deal of influence. A little less than half said it could have a fair amount. Only 4%, though, this is interesting, said the government cannot fix the problem.
Cannot at all. Only 4% said that.
Only 4%.
All right. Well, then let's test that theory a little bit here for a second. What do they say about the solutions that the government has proposed?
Still a lot of doubts on that front,
for
good reason. Again, looking at the markets just this week, you know, the doubts being fed by the fact that Wall Street, with the exception of Monday, remains in a tailspin. So how can we trust and be confident when the pros on Wall Street apparently have no confidence at all? But we're also asking the question, you know, what choice do you have but to trust these institutions? You know, the likes of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. It's held up for 80 years. Are you really going to go keep your money under the mattress? It may take a long time for people to get back into the markets to the extent that they were even a year ago, but history does show us they will.
Who Can You Trust is the title of a special Marketplace Money broadcast this weekend. Tess Vigeland is the host of that program. Tess, thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Kai.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing a wide range of tax-exempt portfolios. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, do you remember back when there used to be two different kinds of gas, leaded and un? One of the reasons there's only unleaded today is a 1978 decision by the Environmental Protection Agency to sharply cut the levels of lead that are allowed in the air. Today, for the very first time since that decision, and in response to a court order, the EPA cut those earlier levels even farther, 90% in fact. It's going to be 8 years, though, before anybody has to do any cleaning up out there. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 401 points, 4.6%. The NASDAQ added 89 points, 5.5%. The S&P 500 gained 38 points. That's 4.1% there. Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in to the Marketplace Morning Report tomorrow for more of Fallout, our coverage of the financial crisis and its aftermath. And on Marketplace, changing the way we measure poverty.
We're considered above the income, so I guess we would be considered that we would be okay, but in reality, we're not.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.